We are excited to have three districts who are joining us today who took my data challenge. As we look at the agenda, it's really divided into two parts. We're going to start with a federal update from our federal consultant, John Bernstein. He's going to let us know what is happening, or in many cases, not happening here in Washington, especially with Title II. And then we're going to jump into our panel, during which each panelist will share with you their data collection journey. And we're leaving time afterwards so that you all can ask questions. Our goals today are to support you in your advocacy journey, and we want to help by giving you some ideas that are working in other districts to help you think about telling your story in a succinct and clear way, and to remind you that data comes in many forms. Throughout the webinar, I hope that you'll use the chat box to write down any questions that you want to make sure we answer as we go. Let's warm up with a little question for all of you that are part of our audience. And so Arielle, who is helping us with our webinar today, is going to open up this poll. But we're interested in what you are each doing in data collection. So we would love for you to take a moment. If you look in the poll questions box on the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see that you can choose as many of those answers as you want to. And we're going to give everybody a few minutes to please enter how you're currently collecting data, and then we'll take a look at what you share. All right, it looks like we're ready to share what we saw. Arielle, can you help us to see the data? There you go. So it looks like we have sort of two big answers. One is not currently collecting data, which we're hoping to help with today. And the other is that it looks like a lot of you are using pre and post surveys, probably of your educators before and during and after, hopefully, whatever you're doing in terms of professional learning. We do see some student test score data and some looking at teacher retention data. So what kinds of data did we miss? If there's anything that we didn't add in here, we would love for you to put that in the chat box. So great news. I'm seeing some folks are doing that. So feedback data. We ask professional development participants to produce and share products such as common assessments. Great. Looking at their work. And we also use self-rating scales around educator growth. Thanks to all of you who jumped in with some additional ideas. We're going to talk a little bit as we go through the day about different kind of, through the webinar, about different kinds of data collection, but this is a really helpful observation data and perception data. Terrific. Thanks for continuing to answer. Student discipline data. Really, that's a great, great addition. We've also seen student absenteeism data as well. So all these different ways to look at how, what the teaching practice is doing for student learning. So terrific ideas. Thanks, everybody. As we dive into the content for today's webinar, we're going to be talking a lot about storytelling. And advocacy is about sharing your story. One of the things that we've really been working on at Learning Forward and through our advocacy efforts is the use of Twitter as a great way to do that. So while it is short messages and ideas, we do encourage you to tweet during and after today's webinar and to tag Learning Forward so that we don't miss your messages. And if you want to write something about Title IIA, please use the hashtag that's listed on the screen, so again, so that we're able to find those messages that you're putting out there about Title II. We're going to start our program, as I mentioned earlier, with a Title II update from John Bernstein. John, hopefully, is a familiar name for many of you. John has been working with Learning Forward, helping us to fight for Title IIA at the federal level for the past 2 years. And we're incredibly grateful for his advice and counsel and ideas, as well as for his keeping us up to date, up to the minute on developments that are happening in DC. So this is just a great chance to give you one of those up to the minute updates. So I'm going to turn it over to you, John.
Thanks, Melinda, and good afternoon, everyone. It's really a pleasure to be with you here today. Before I dive into the tangled web that really is federal funding, I want to emphasize to everybody just how important this webinar is that you're about to hear. Data is absolutely vital in making the case that the federal government and even state and local governments should fund professional development. Unfortunately, here in Washington, I would not be honest if I didn't tell you that the Department of Education is not doing a particularly good job of collecting data on Title II, which is the professional development title that so many of you draw resources from, perhaps even salaries from, and that is so critical to the success of students. If the Department of Education is not going to do it, that means it's up to all of us to do it. And I can tell you that in the past couple of years, Learning Forward's done a terrific job of starting to get folks into this position where they can put together their data sets in a very easily readable document that can be dropped off and used repeatedly and even updated for Hill staff. And Hill staff love it. They love to see exactly how the dollars are being used. They also are interested to see how far the dollars go from 1 year to the next. One of our big arguments about Title II is that even though we have won in the sense that the program has not been eliminated, the fact is that we're still getting the same amount of money for this program that we got 10 years ago. And that money does not go as far as it used to be, because things cost more, because there are different costs associated with those dollars and that are dragging on those dollars. So we need to make the argument continuously that while $2 billion for Title II each year seems like a lot of money, it's not a lot of money when you think about it was the same amount of money that we were receiving a decade ago. So this webinar is going to be really useful and critical, and I definitely encourage all of you, if you can, to develop your own data set so that you can take that up to your members of Congress, up to your senators, and even use it within your own districts and schools to show how these dollars are being spent, because it's absolutely critical to know how well these dollars are being spent and how valuable they are. So with that, let me tell you a little bit about where we are in the process. For those of you who have listened to me before, you know that we have an annual federal appropriations process, that every year the appropriations process, first of all, the fiscal year is supposed to run from October 1 to September 30th, and every year the appropriations bills, 12 of them that Congress handles, are supposed to be done by September 30th so that the dollars can flow smoothly. Well, last year, that worked out. We actually managed to get the appropriations process for the education funding bill done on time, and everybody got their money, including an increase, on time last year. The problem is that this year, we are now at December 3rd, and we are more than 2 months over that October 1 deadline, and I don't see an end in sight. Congress has not completed its work on any of the appropriations bills for fiscal year 2020. Including the labor HHS education bill that contains Title II, the professional development funding that we've been talking about. On December 20th is the last day for them to do something before they have to do something else. December 20th is essentially the date we have as a deadline before the temporary budget that Congress has been operating under runs out. If there is no deal by December 20th, there are essentially three options on the table. One option is that we simply kick the can further down the road, that we give ourselves another temporary budget for another couple months and give Congress some more time to work this out. Secondly, we could actually adopt what's known as a full year temporary budget or a full year continuing resolution. and maybe a term that you've heard before, which would mean that you would get the same amount of money as you got for all of these programs at last year's spending levels. That sounds good to us in some respects, again, because Title II would get $2 billion, which is what it has always gotten, and it wouldn't be in danger of a cut. However, we did particularly well in the House version of education funding this year and would have gotten a $500 million increase for Title II if the House bill had become law. So if you do a full year continuing resolution, what ends up happening is that all gets wiped out and you're simply just getting the same money you got last year. There is one third option, one more option that is not particularly palatable either, and that would be to shut the government down. And I have to tell you that I didn't think that was a possibility until this morning when I saw some news that indicated that the president is considering actually not signing any appropriations bills on December 20th unless he gets everything he wants for his southern border wall, which funding for which is still up in the air. So we may be facing a very difficult decision come December 20th about whether there's going to be any money at all for the government, whether we're going to get funded at last year's levels, or I guess the fourth option is we actually get all this done in the next 3 weeks. So the next 3 weeks, by the way, are still critical, and the time that we have between now and December 20th, and then even the time possibly after December 20th are important because there's still chances to make your case for professional development dollars. There's still a chance to make that argument that we need more than the $2 billion, that it doesn't go as far as it used to. And by the way, here's the data about what we're spending our dollars on and what we would spend our dollars on if given the chance. So now is a good time, if you haven't done it yet, to maybe reach out to your congressmen and senators and let them know that Title II is important to you and what you're doing with it and what you'd like to see in terms of funding, which would be, from our perspective, the $500 billion increase that was offered in the House's version of this appropriations bill. So I know that's a lot to take in, but all I will ask of you is to keep doing the good work you're doing, gather your data, and if you have some time, pay attention to what's going on up out here in Washington and maybe let your congressmen and senators know how important Title II is, because now is sort of the last chance you're going to get for this funding year probably to really push for a Title II increase. So with that, Melinda, I will hand it back to you, and I guess I will take any questions if there are some.
That's great, John, and thank you for the update. Are there any questions for John that you want to put in the chat box? And I do know Christopher Thompson put in a really interesting comment about the sort of figuring out what the right impact data to share around professional learning is. And so, Christopher, I think that your question is a really good one. Students' needs differ from year to year. Professional learning may differ from year to year. How do you know how to make the best sort of presentation? And that actually is very much what we're going to talk about today, which is thinking about who your audience is that you want to share your story with, and thinking about how to collect data that could appeal to them or to others throughout the process. So it's a great comment and one that we'll definitely keep in mind as we go through today's webinar. So panelists, I would encourage you to check out that comment as well. Any questions from John? John, it sounds like there's a lot of questions just around what's going to happen overall. So thanks for laying out the options for us. All right. So our webinar today is focused on evidence and impact. And these are really foundational words for what happens in education, but not necessarily words that every educator thinks of as his or her responsibility. My hope is that today and through our Every Educator is an Advocate campaign that we can increase your understanding of the power of evidence and help you think about ways to incorporate measurement and evidence into your everyday work, no matter what your role is in education. John mentioned, you know, making a case at the federal level or in state and local governments. I would say that evidence makes a difference when you're trying to make a case in your classroom, with your PTA, with your principal, with your school district, with whoever it is that you need to share what's going on and how it's making a difference. And so I wanted to share today just a couple of tips that we think of as we think of every educator being an advocate. First is that measurement can and should be built into every single professional learning initiative. And the incorporation of the measurement should be considered at the planning stage of a professional learning initiative. So this is actually, Christopher, this goes back to your comment earlier. So you, when you're thinking about who you're going to need to share the impact of what you're doing with, is it to get more funding from your district to continue a professional learning effort? Is it to share evidence with your superintendent about how a student learning has changed as a result? Thinking about all of these different audiences that you may want to reach as a result of the work that you're doing means that different kinds of measurements can and should be built in very early in the process. I've talked to a number of educators who say, well, I didn't know it was going to be a good thing until I was doing it. And so it's really hard to go back and try to share the impact of your good thing and the professional learning if you haven't captured where you were as a starting point. So think about measurement early on in any professional learning initiative that you're doing. Second, remember that data can take many forms. This goes back to our question up at the top of the webinar. Student test scores, of course, are terrific, but they are not the only indicator of success, particularly when looking at the impact of professional learning. So other measures might include changes in teacher retention. You're going to hear about that today. Or it might be pre and post need surveys of teachers that point to changes in teacher efficacy. Or it might be changes in the number of schools that you have on the schools in need of improvement list after time goes by. So if you have a great data point that I haven't captured, that wasn't captured earlier, we would love for you to continue to add into the chat box. Another point is that you may have many, many data stories and successes to share, and we, Learning Forward, want to hear them all. But as you think about telling your data story, consider your audience and try to distill out single stories that show impact. And you're going to hear this in our panelist descriptions today. All three of these professional learning leaders are doing terrific work in their districts, and there are many things that they could share as successes as a result of their work. But what we really have focused on is what's that one data point that you can put into a story that makes the impact prominent and the data accessible. So we don't want our audiences, whoever they might be, to have to dig for the answers. And we at Learning Forward have been doing this through what we call data summaries, and you're going to see some of these today shared by our panelists. And we're building a library of these examples on our advocacy website. The link is right there on the screen. And so we invite you to take a look at these great stories and think about the story that you have to share. So now let's hear from our panelists. We are so fortunate to have three professional learning experts with us today, and even more fortunate because they agreed to go on this data journey with Learning Forward. Over the past several weeks, we have been working with each of them on their data story. They had the great work and the data, and we tried to help with distilling it out into a data summary. So each story that you're going to hear is comprised of three parts. What was the challenge in your district that you wanted to use professional learning to address? What was the professional learning initiative or intervention or solution that you employed to address that challenge? And then probably the most important piece is, how do you know it made a difference? What was the impact? So our first panelist is Amy Suma. Amy leads teacher leadership development for the School District of Philadelphia in Pennsylvania. Prior to this role, Amy worked in Philly as well as in Coatesville and the Unionville Chadsford School Districts as a consulting teacher, a classroom teacher, a teacher leader, and even as a high school girls basketball coach. And Amy has worked closely between the Chester County Intermediate Union and Goddard Space Flight Center to raise student achievement in math and science. We're then going to hear from Kathy Ruggeberg, the Assistant Superintendent for Teaching and Learning in the Rock Island Milan School District in Illinois, where she has led the implementation of standards-based grading for grades K-8, as well as new ELA math and science curricula. Prior to her current role, Kathy was also a teacher serving in settings from pre-K through college, special education, and general education. She was a dean, an assistant principal, and a principal before taking on her current role. We will then hear from Beth Albert. Some of you may recognize Beth as she was part of our Capitol Hill briefing in October this year. Beth is the Executive Director of Professional Development and Student Achievement for Norman Public Schools in Oklahoma. In this position, she is responsible for planning and coordinating all staff development required and supported by the district, and for overseeing the district's benchmark testing program and its compliance with the state's testing and school accountability mandates. Prior to this role, a familiar theme, Beth was a principal, assistant principal, and an elementary school teacher. We've asked each of the panelists to speak for about 5 minutes. As I said before, they're only highlighting one data story from among many that they could share. Once all three panelists have shared their story, then we will open it up to a discussion among all of them and questions from the audience. So if you have questions as they are speaking, please put them in the chat box and we will circle back to answer as many questions as possible. So, Amy, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Great, take it away.
All right, thank you so much. Hi to everybody who's here. I'm going to present on what is maybe a pretty unique situation, especially for those of you that are tuning in. So to give a brief history on where we came to in Philadelphia about 2 years ago when we started tackling this issue was 10 years prior where the district implemented what's called school-based teacher leaders or SBTLs. And these individuals were in multiple K-8 schools. They received professional development from central office and really were the instructional leaders in the building. The district hit financial hardship about 10 years ago. And in that situation, all non-essential staff were pulled from school buildings. And so that often meant that assistant principals were no longer in school buildings. So principals utilize their school-based teacher leader, or SBTL, in any way or capacity that they needed to efficiently run their building. So a lot of our SBTLs stayed as instructional leaders. Others took on pseudo-administrative roles. Others took on community partner roles. So these positions of school-based teacher leaders just morphed depending on what the school leader in school building really needed at that time. So fast forward 10 years, which would be 2017-2016, at central office, we started talking and recognized that there was an issue. We had school-based teacher leaders out there that were not getting any professional development, any support from central office, and they were doing the best they can in the buildings and often going out and getting the leadership development from, you know, universities, other organizations, et cetera. And we really wanted to bring more support and development to our teacher leaders, but we also wanted to make sure that we were guiding our teacher leaders in the roles and responsibilities that would bring them back to being an instructional leader, as well as assisting principals, and now that we have APs back in the buildings, how to support their school-based teacher leaders as an instructional leader. So we started this journey about 2 years ago, and the challenge was building our teacher leaders' capacity around instructional leadership skills. So we dug in, we did some research, we partnered with the Center for Teacher Quality, and we did that historical research. We had design teams that consisted of our school-based teacher leaders, principals, APs, assistant superintendent, the teachers union, and we really just wanted to figure out what it was that our teacher leaders needed for them to be successful, for them to coach and promote success for our teachers, and then of course, that would lend itself to our student achievement. So through those design teams, we established the clear need for what types of professional development that they needed in terms of support. And we also identified that they needed a clear job description. So that was taken care of, but we really wanted to focus on the professional development and support that we could offer them. So in the district, we have leadership competencies, and the leadership competencies span various roles, from teacher leader to central office leader, principal, assistant principal, and assistant superintendent. So we really focused in on the teacher leader portion of the competencies to help drive our professional development. So last year was the first year that we implemented monthly professional development for our teacher leaders. Last year, we had roughly 170 school-based teacher leaders. This year, we have quite a few more, but we had 3 days, consecutive days of professional development a month where SBTLs were asked to come one of those 3 days. So typically, we had about 50 SBTLs with us per day each month, and we focused on various skills around coaching supports, diagnosing what they're seeing in classroom visits, adapting their personal leadership skills, maintaining a growth mindset, because we know that different atmospheres are challenging. So we conducted a pre-needs assessment in October. We had a pretty good idea of what we thought we were going to focus on based on the leadership competencies, so we wanted to validate that through a pre-needs assessment, and we partnered with our Office of Research and Evaluation to help us do that. So we did the pre-needs assessment to finalize what the professional development was going to look like for the whole school year. And of course, we did like our mini surveys with our participants after each session. But we also implemented a K-8 SBTL advisory board. So it's a group of about 8 school-based teacher leaders in the K-8 world, and they are known as from their peers as the advisory board. So if anyone had an issue or a comment or a thought or a concern, not only could they come to us, but they could also come to the advisory board. And we have these supports in place to really drive the development from last year. And we're very happy to say that we've seen a jump in their self-reported confidence levels for these indicators that we've highlighted here on the screen for you. We know that there are still some gaps, quite a few gaps that we need to fill in terms of support and development, and where we really want to see our school-based teacher leaders excel. But we are very proud of the growth that we've made over the last couple years. We started as a team of one, yours truly, and we are now currently a team of 5. So slowly, maybe not even slowly growing, but growing, and will be growing in the future. So I've utilized this data to support driving the personnel at Central Office that can support our teacher leaders in terms of professional development. Based off of the data on the pre-post needs assessment, and then another opportunity for development that we included last year, we piloted what's called the Teacher Leader Academy, and it's a cohort development group that gets professional development once a month, including an intensive summer course and personalized leadership development from a coach. And I utilize that data in comparison with the data that you're seeing on the screen to help promote our need for individualized leadership coaching from our office. So this school year, because of utilizing that data, we now have individualized leadership coaching, and we have some peer site visits happening. So it's pretty exciting that we have these supports in place. I feel like we're at a much better place than we were previously, but we still have a ways to go.
Thank you, Amy. Such a great story. You will see that there are a couple of questions that are in the chat box. And so, Amy, you might want to take a look at those. And I'm going to move on to the next panelist, but either you can answer those in the chat box or we'll come back to them as a group. So thank you so much.
Thanks.
All right, Kathy, you're up.
Oh gosh, Amy did such a great job, so I'm going to try my best to follow up as succinctly as she did. I'm happy to share anything further with anyone after the webinar via phone or email. So in short, I came into the district as a principal of one of our highest poverty and highest diverse schools in the district, and that was in 2011-12. And after 2 years there, the assistant superintendent at the time had asked that I join him here in the central office. They were making some switches and some funding cuts, and so when there were two assistant superintendents in our office and two or more instructional coach format style teachers that we called teachers on special assignment, the district had made some drastic cuts. And so I came on as the Director of Grants, Assessment, and Accountability. And literally the day I was offered the job and accepted, the assistant superintendent put in his resignation that he was going to move back home. So in short, I came into a lot of great things starting to happen, but we hadn't necessarily put in the professional development needed in order to unleash some of these great things that had been started. So my very first year here, we had failed the search to find the assistant superintendent, and so I took on both the assistant superintendent and the director role with the instructional coaches cut as well. So it was myself and the secretary. A district of 14 schools, at that time we were about 6,700 students. We had pre-K through 12. So we had a lot of different concerns going on, but lots of opportunity for growth and lots of things that I knew we could accomplish with time and effort and collaboration. So the first thing that I came into was the release of standards-based grading at the elementary level. However, all it entailed was that summer bringing in a group of teachers, showing them some other standards-based grading report cards and having them write ours, and that was the extent. We just unleashed it. And so that didn't go so well, as you could imagine. So we spent that first fall trying diligently. I, at that point, had got the opportunity to bring in a teacher that I had been working with in the past to come into the department to help me in the curriculum office. She was great support, but we worked that first year primarily on how do we assist everyone in understanding what does this shift in grading practices and reporting look like. What does it mean to staff, to students, to parents? And in a nutshell, it worked because the elementary teachers that were the first to conquer this put their nose to the grind, helped unveil different resources. They collaborated with all of us and shared resources with each other. And so we began that journey by continuing to go a day at a time and learning from our mistakes as we then began to enhance it further in the junior high level. To be completely honest, it still is a concern in some areas. However, it has forced all of us, teachers, staff, administrators, students, and parents, to look at learning in a different way. No longer do we provide just a simple B on a report card because they fell between the 80 and 90% range in math. We as educators have to become more skilled to know where are the students' strengths in math and where are their weaknesses in math and how do we help support them, their parents, and each other in gaining additional success in those areas. So we're continuing to look at that. We have continued to provide surveys and get feedback from staff and parents. At one point, we offered to go back to more of the traditional style and our parents said no. So we continue to seek feedback and we continue to make adjustments and refinements as we go forward. As that year proceeded through, our high school, unfortunately, was listed as one of the lowest performing schools in the state of Illinois. And in that, you are provided the opportunity to apply for a school improvement grant. We made that difficult decision to move forward with that, and the high school was awarded with that grant. With that grant came lots of money to do a lot of things, however, a very short time frame, and massive change occurred in a very short time frame. So we used many of our title dollars to support our other schools who were not receiving those school improvement grant funds so that they could receive much of the same learning that we were experiencing at the high school level with the school improvement grant funds by bringing in consultants, experts from the field in certain areas we'd identified for the high school specifically that we knew we could learn from across the board. All of that money comes into your lap, and honestly, it's so much you're not sure how to use it and use the most effective. And so a lot of our money was used to buy technology. So at that same time, we had standards-based grading, school improvement grants deployment at our high school. The very following year, we had two elementaries listed in the lowest performing as well. So what that means is we had three schools at that time in basically the 2015-16 school year that were performing in the lowest 5% of the state of Illinois. Not an honor or an award we were proud of. So we used information, we kind of put our nose to the grind. It was a very tiring process, and I guarantee that if you asked anybody about the SIG experience, there may be a lot of things we learned from it, but a lot of things that caused a lot of confusion, frustration, tired feeling, et cetera. But in the end, we're now seeing some of the fruit from all of that hard work across those years. So in that time of the school improvement grant, not only had we unveiled standards-based grading, the state of Illinois came in and said, due to you having three schools in the lowest 5% of the state, we are requiring you that you, within 30 days, implement a English language arts fully aligned curriculum K-12. Oh, goodness. We had been in the process of piloting a math curriculum at the elementary level because prior to me arriving, the district had adopted a 6th through high school curriculum program. So we were looking at that at the elementary level, and we had a full pilot going on. We were ready to make a recommendation with an entire year worth of full pilot with professional development, with professional learning community involvement from all of those pilot stakeholders, with student surveys and parent surveys. And we were ready to make a recommendation for a math curriculum in the elementary level, and the state didn't believe that that was enough. They forced us not only to do that, but also to implement a fully aligned English language arts curriculum K-12 and identify that within 30 days. So, of course, we put our nose to the grind and we did that. But because we didn't have the time to do a full pilot, we didn't have full staff buy-in at that time either. So it's been a very difficult process with implementing new math curriculum, new language arts curriculum. After that, we found that the curriculum that had been adopted in math from 6th through high school was not working, and in fact, Ed reports showed that it was in dire red fashion across the board. So we then began piloting, and this year we have implemented a curriculum in 6th through 8th grade, as well as we moved away from the integrated math pathway at the high school to the traditional math pathway at the high school. We believe that our scores are showing some excellent results from this hard work. As you can see on the screen, we have the ELA in the orange color and math in the red color. When we began much of this really hard work, we started looking at the 15-16 data, and for English language arts, we were scoring around the 14 or 15% range in state percentile of students meeting or exceeding, and we've increased that to 21. And in math, we were at the 13 or 14%, and we've increased that to 22. That may not be a large jump, but when I compare it to the state and to what we previously were not seeing in years past, it's a huge celebration for our school district. The state of Illinois, in that same time period, has grown only 1% in math, where we grew 7. They've grown only 2% in ELA, or I'm sorry, 1% in math, where we have grown 6, and 2% in ELA, where we have grown 7. And so we are extremely happy about those results. We know that we are on the mark of making even higher progress because of the work that's happening. But in order for us to do that work, we had to completely shift our mindset on how we were using funds, when we were releasing teachers, how we were bringing in experts, how we were looking at a rigorous, fully aligned curriculum. And so those dollars have been used in that fashion for us to take a look at how can we make sure that we're driving for higher results?
Awesome. Thank you, Kathy. I really appreciate, too, your coming back to the data on the slide and showing that upward trajectory. It's really exciting. All right, Beth from Norman, Oklahoma. Tell us your story.
Good afternoon. I'm happy to be here with you this afternoon and share our story. My story, or our story, the story of Norman Public Schools, is that of teacher retention. I have been in my current position now since 2012 as the Executive Director of Staff Development, and part of that role is overseeing our new teacher induction program. Back in 2012, on average, we were hiring around 150 new teachers annually. That would be, you know, just your typical retirements, teachers moving to new positions, the need for additional teachers in classrooms. But the average number was anywhere between 125 and 150. In fact, that first year of induction for me in 2012, there were 150 teachers that came through. And as I started to kind of watch and look, these numbers steadily increased year after year. We were not retaining teachers. The number kept increasing. In fact, in 2017, we had 225 teachers coming through new teacher induction. And it was at that point that really we were alarmed, because we couldn't keep up. And we knew that it was imperative that we intensify our efforts to support these teachers and retain them, because we knew that our principals were hiring what they believed to be the very best. What were we then doing in return in the area of professional learning to grow them and develop them and provide the resources they needed to be effective educators in the classroom? So with that, we really started to allocate our Title II funds on professional learning for our teachers new to the district, especially those entry year teachers and emergency certified teachers, teachers that had gone a non-traditional path. So we continue and have continued to provide mentor teachers to our entry year teachers. So these teachers are paid a stipend for their work with their new teachers. And we require that they spend a certain number of hours with them on a monthly basis, and they're that main support for teachers. And again, that's something we've been doing for years. But in addition to that, we placed a teacher support specialist in each of our schools, all elementary, middle, and high schools. We, I apologize, not a teacher support specialist, but a new teacher liaison. A new teacher liaison was that additional link, because it's not just your entry year teachers that need help. Anytime you hire a new teacher to the district, even if they have several years of experience, districts operate in different ways. And so that new teacher liaison was there to show them the ropes of Norman Public Schools, but specifically cite how the site operated to make sure that they weren't missing any information. So those new teacher liaisons were a critical piece that we added 2 years ago. Additionally, as I spoke about the growing number of emergency certified teachers, you know, I think back to my first year in Norman, I could count on one hand the number of emergency certified teachers that we had in our district. And that number has grown. It's blown up. In fact, we were able with Title II funds to add even more support for our emergency certified, and I'll go back to that in a minute. But we found that these emergency certified teachers may have the content knowledge, but they're lacking that classroom management piece. And so we implemented a program called Fast Track to Classroom Management, using Title II funds to help these teachers learn to run an effective classroom. What tips and tricks can they use? We send them out to observe veteran teachers in the classroom that have stellar classroom management, and that program has been very, very helpful to our new teachers and to our teachers that have gone a less traditional path. But the thing that has been most impactful, and this was something we just implemented last year, I contracted with two teacher support specialists. These, one was actually a retired classroom teacher from the Norman Public Schools, and the other was a former administrator in the Norman Public Schools. And these two teacher support specialists were able to go in and visit classrooms and support teachers real time. So they could go in and co-teach a lesson with teachers or model or just observe and give suggestions. The beauty of this is that they're non-evaluative. They became confident to these teachers. And during last year, we had 109 teachers in our district supported by these teacher support specialists, and these two teacher support specialists logged over 270 classroom visits. I will tell you that I believe that this was the key factor, along with the other professional learning solutions that we implemented, that was a difference maker in supporting and retaining teachers, because we did log the classroom visits. We knew which classrooms those teachers had been in and the number of those teachers that we actually have back in the classroom this year. I will tell you that that program was such a success that this year I actually hired three teacher support specialists. I have one at each level, elementary, middle, and high school, and they spend the majority of their time in entry year teachers' classrooms, even though those teachers have a mentor teacher. Again, an additional layer of support. They are in those emergency certified teachers' classrooms. They are coaching and developing our teachers. The difference there is that they can go in and spend a full day if they need to, where a mentor teacher actually has their own classroom, and so they don't have the time during the actual school day to provide that support. I will tell you, when we looked at numbers, this year going through new teacher induction, we only had 168 teachers. And I know that sounds like a lot, but when you were considering back in 2017 that we hired 225, we were thrilled. And I will tell you, the one piece is that when you have this type of data and then you make a request for PD, people listen and they know that what you're doing is working. So you know, I think about this year I made a very specific request for emergency certified teachers, and I'm actually partnering with Learning Forward Oklahoma to provide a base camp, which is building and supporting educators for our emergency certified teachers. And it was without question that this request was approved, because again, when you have data to support what you're doing, you just can't argue with it. So we are thrilled with what we're doing. I mentioned back in October that if funds allowed, if we could have an increase in our Title II funds, I would double that number, because I think the more support that we can provide in the actual classroom for these teachers, where we're not having to pull them out to attend training but bring that job-embedded PD into the classroom, it makes a huge, huge difference. So we're very excited about what our data is telling us, and we will continue to collect data as we move forward.
Awesome. Thank you very much. And thanks to all three panelists. I love the different types of data stories that you each shared, and you all already started answering my first question, which was really how are you going to use the data to influence policy, practice, and funding decisions in your district? And I heard a couple of people already reference that, but I don't know if anybody wants to add to that question. How are you going to be using this data? And actually, do you have additional data that you plan to start collecting?
You know, we're going to continue that way. What what we've had some success at is that professional development offering, where years past it was continually pulling teachers out of the classroom, and we try our best not to do that. So we're switching how we've been using title funding to provide miscellaneous pay and actual hour credit for them outside of the contract, so that our students still get the best teacher, which is them in front of them. We've had some good success. I have been reading Assessing Impact by Jolene Killian, and that's been refreshing because we were doing some of the right things that I didn't quite know we were doing correctly, but there's a lot of good information in that book that will help drive our additional PD needs, which come with dollars as well.
Thank you. Amy or Beth?
Yeah, I can speak to that on two accounts. So our schools are not required to have a school-based teacher leader. So what our plan of action is with our Office of Research and Evaluation is really to try to drill down and figure out how much our SBTLs are affecting not only teacher retention, but student achievement, and then possibly do some shifting of funds, because right now our principals are using their own budget money to, like their school's budget money, to have a school-based teacher leader, and we want to bring that funding stream for SBTLs to central office. So one, looking at retention data and student achievement data, and then moving some funds around to allow all schools to have teacher leaders, not just those who can manipulate some funds to buy them, so to speak.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it's important that there is equity with professional learning, and again, we're excited to look at data. And I think the next piece will be, now that we're starting to retain teachers, going ahead and looking at that piece of the student achievement piece associated with these students. So still a lot of work to be done, but very exciting work.
Great, thank you. Any lessons learned that any of you all want to share about data collection? Anybody fall into the trap that I described at the beginning, where you thought, oh shoot, I should have measured at the beginning, or any lessons learned through this sort of thinking about how to collect and compile and use data?
I mean, I think we always learn that. We always think, oh shoot, I wish I would have gathered this at the start, but we'll always continue to get better. And as much as it's difficult to think about those, what we've become better at is not planning a minute behind, but looking a few days ahead. And
nice.
And that comes with just getting our ducks in a row here and being proactive rather than reactive.
I think for me here in Philly, you know, we collected some data. We're constantly expanding what data we're collecting, et cetera. But for me, it's more about thinking strategically about who I'm sharing the data with, whether it's assistant superintendents. I think we have 14 or 15 assistant superintendents. And then like our chief of academics and our chief of schools. So how not only am I gathering this data, but then sharing it out for impact.
I would agree with that. I mean, it's never too late to start, and I think we actually all have more data than we realize.
Yeah.
And so it's putting it together to tell that story and then sharing that story.
Great. And I will add that I've had the pleasure of working with all three of you around these data stories. And what you just said, Beth, is so true. There is each of you sort of came to the conversations the first time saying, well, you know, I don't know how much data we have, but blah, blah, blah. And then you would share some tremendous piece of data that told a great story. And so I would encourage all of you on the phone to sort of think about what you have that you might not think, well, I was collecting this for the purpose of making the case, but in fact, you've been collecting it and you can use it now to make the case. So a shout out to all three of the leaders on the phone who have really thought about what they have and how they can use it to tell a story. The other thing I'll mention is that up on the screen right now are the full data summaries that that were developed for the stories that you've heard today. These are available on the Learning Forward Advocacy website. So if you go to learningforward.org/advocacy, on the right-hand side, you'll see a button that says Data Summary. So you can find these in PDF format there, as well as a number of other examples that could give you some great ideas for data collection in your own districts. Somebody mentioned that professional learning is an equity issue, and I would love to loop back to that for a minute and have any or all of you comment on why professional learning is an equity issue and how data can help support that.
So I can just speak to equity in terms of access to support of our teacher leaders. So although we do professional development, you know, we give the 3 days every month for them to attend, who's not to say that there's not going to be an emergency at their school or that they can't attend due to another reason, something like that where they don't have access to the professional development. But as I also mentioned, we're a pretty small team right now, and although we offer individualized leadership coaching, I know for a fact that we're not reaching as many teacher leaders on that one-to-one level that we really should be. So, I mean, that to me is one of our equity issues, just not being able to give the support we know that they deserve.
Well, and I'll speak to the fact, you know, some of the professional learning opportunities that we do provide require to pull teachers out of the classroom, and, you know, sometimes we don't have enough subs in our sub pool to allow these teachers to attend. And so that's the beauty of our teacher support specialists being able to go into the classroom, because no sub is required. And all, you know, it allows us to improve all of our teachers, no matter what school they're in or what the circumstances are, because ultimately all of our students deserve to have the very best teachers in the classroom.
With all of that as well, we aren't fortunate enough yet to have an instructional coach of the sort in every one of our buildings, but where we do, we see some of our highest results and the most impactful learning happening.
Wonderful. We had a comment from on the chat box that says data must be disaggregated to find the inequities, and I think that's a great point as to think about how and I think this again speaks to audience and also to how it's shared. It's what you really want to do is to be able to point to inequities that exist and how certain professional learning programs are helping to reach schools, teachers, students that otherwise might not have been reached and therefore are being more equitable in professional learning offerings. Then I think that's a great point. We need to be able to share the data in a way that shows not only the broad picture, but also across in that disaggregated format. So thanks, Dolores, for that reminder. I am cognizant of the time. I want to start by thanking our panelists. It has been a pleasure for me working with all of you, and I'm really excited about the stories and the data summaries that you all are sharing. So thank you for your time over the last several weeks and, of course, today. I want to give a shout out to our affiliates in Illinois and Oklahoma who helped us to find these great leaders, as well as our redesigned professional development community. I think that we are so lucky in the leadership and the resources that we have in our community, and so glad to be able to have you all share with us today. I want to thank Ariel Kane, who helped make sure that all of our technical efforts ran smoothly today, and I want to thank everyone for joining us at the end of the day. I hope that you are leaving inspired to collect and compile data around professional learning, and that you will join us in sharing your story. I also hope that you're planning to join us in St. Louis next week for the Learning Forward Annual Conference. We will have an advocacy booth that will be right across from the registration table, so please come say hello to me, to others on the advocacy team, sign our professional learning petition, and share your advocacy story. And if you haven't already done so, please join the Learning Forward A team or advocacy team. This is a no pain, lots of gain opportunity to stay up to date on all things policy. And you can sign up either at this link that's on our advocacy webpage, or you can do it at the advocacy booth in St. Louis. So with that, I want to say thank you again to everybody, and I hope you have a great day, and I look forward to seeing you in St. Louis.